All right, thank you. We're back. You can be seated. I'll make a couple of remarks before we begin with our third final argument. I think you're both aware about how the time works. You should have a clock on the podium that tells how much time is remaining. We typically have a five-minute period of time reserved for rebuttal for appellants. The podium does adjust if you need to do that. There's a button to do that. And I would also ask that before you begin, you take a minute to pronounce your name for us so we know how to say it. And if there are any specific preferences that you or your clients have about how we should refer to you, just let us know at that time as well. And Marshall, will you call the next case?
Now calling case number A230197, in re the Lawrence B. Schwagerl Trust Agreement, Trust Under Agreement, dated April 9th, 1999.
Whenever you're ready, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Joseph Ganji. I represent the appellants in this matter, the Lawrence Schwagerl Trust and the Phyllis Schwagerl Trust. I can't say I'm too thrilled to be here on this case yet again, but the district court continues to make some errors that need to be corrected. And we have two primary issues in this appeal. They're related issues, but they're also very different. The first issue being whether a trustee is entitled to reimbursement, and then the second issue being where does that reimbursement come from. On the first question of whether Mr. Wilson here is entitled to reimbursement, the district court's award of over $80,000 in fees and expenses was an abuse of discretion, at least in part, and should be reversed, at least in part. On the second question, for where that reimbursement comes from, that's not really a question because the reimbursement comes from the trust, meaning the Lawrence Trust. But here, the district court ordered reimbursement from a different trust, the Phyllis Trust, and that was legal error. And I'd ask that the judgment against the Phyllis Trust be reversed. I'd like to start with a few points on this latter argument on where reimbursement come from, and then move to a few points on the amount that the district court awarded to Mr. Wilson. So we talk about where reimbursement comes from. It's important to recognize that a trust is essentially a self-contained vehicle. It has its own assets, it has its own terms, it has its own rules, it establishes a trusteeship. Everything is within this vehicle. And reimbursement, trustees certainly are entitled to reimbursement, but it's all tied to this vehicle that's been created by the trust itself. So if they're seeking reimbursement, that comes from the trust.
Can you tell me, counsel, what's in the Lawrence Trust?
As we, right now, what's in the Lawrence Schwagerl Trust is...
At the time of the court's order.
Mm-hmm. Is the undivided one-half interest in the land.
Okay, which is subject to the contract for deed, right? Is that...
Correct.
Okay. So, to seek payment of fees and attorney's fees out of that, if they're reasonable, et cetera, satisfy the other obligations to pay the trust, the trustee in your view would have to take action, I guess, to try and collect against that, which would probably be impossible.
Agreed.
Okay. So here's my question for you, just practically, and then you can get to legal stuff. I'm just looking at this case. Let's say at the start of this case, before the assets move from the Lawrence Trust to the Phyllis Trust, the cash assets as well as real property. Before that happened, someone got an inkling that it's going to happen and, you know, brought an action. The court appointed a trustee to the Lawrence Trust, stopped the transfer of the assets in dispute over to the Phyllis one, decided it all. And then at the same litigation that we had, and then at the end of the day, though, the courts decide, yep, this stuff can, just like now, this stuff can go to the Phyllis Trust. That's not a problem. That's not a breach of fiduciary duty, et cetera. But before that happens, the court pays the trustee out of the Lawrence Trust because there's all the assets are still there. They're all been held while there's a deck action or something deciding whether they can go. I mean, there the trustee would get paid out of these self-same assets, I think, unless you tell me wrong, differently. And then the remainder would go. what happened here is everything went first, and then the trustee was obligated to sort of try and claw it back by the court. That seems to me not fair to a trustee, and also just sort of the operation of trustees, you know, appointed by a court to investigate it, to take action. That seems problematic to me. So this is a very idiosyncratic, and you're here, I think, representing both trusts. Both trusts are part, if I heard you right.
Correct.
Both trusts are parties to, you know, like, not the original litigation, perhaps, but, like, all the things that are on the caption at the time of this court's order. It just seems so idiosyncratic what happened in this case. We don't have some third party out there who you're trying to claw it back from. We have these parties in this dispute.
Correct. Yeah, and to address that point, Your Honor, what we have here is assets that never should have been in the Lawrence Trust, really, to begin with. And so they were not at the Lawrence Trust's disposal for anything, really. And when they get moved, I think the timing is also important. They get moved prior to Mr. Wilson's appointment.
That's my point.
Yeah, and they're even moved. Phyllis Schwagel actually died before Mr. Wilson was appointed. And so they're moved. Mr. Wilson is charged with doing an accounting of the trust. And at that point, he knows that all these assets have been moved. And so by continuing his work, you know, it's like any other trustee who is doing work on behalf of a trust that does not have any assets, where are you going to get reimbursement from?
Well, let's say, though, that the district court's order that it was a breach of fiduciary duty after trial to change, and we'll take another case where they should never have been moved. We want those cases to be able to be brought. We don't want trustees to look at a trust that's been wrongfully depleted and not take on that work to actually address it. Let's say that we, you know, the district court had been affirmed in this case. You know, I know it wasn't, but... You know, the question to pay the trustee is not whether you win or lose, so I'm, like, leaving the reasonableness issue out of it. But just the fact that a trust has been depleted, and so why would any reasonable trustee try to take action to get the assets back doesn't seem right, right?
Well, and again, we have to go back to what are the assets in the trust. The trustee is accepting a court appointment, and the court says you're going to be reimbursed from the Lawrence Trust. Not the Phyllis Trust, not any other trust, but it's from the Lawrence Schwagel Trust. And if there are no assets in there...
No one should take that job.
No one should take that job.
Okay, so no one should say, yeah, court, I agree, I'll take that. We should have no neutrals doing it. That seems kind of a problem.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, Mr. Wilson did his due diligence prior to accepting the appointment. It's not that somebody is appointed and they have no choice but to accept.
You see the problem, though, right? You see why there's the value in having the court be involved in this way, and the problem that we wouldn't be able to pay trustees and no one would take those jobs if you tie it to whether you win or lose.
It's not necessarily tied to whether you win or lose. It's tied to what
there would be assets in the trust if, and I don't want to use the words win and lose, but for lack of a better term, a different outcome could have resulted in assets in this case in the trust that would be there. And so that's what I'm saying. Whether the assets remain in the trust or somewhere else shouldn't be the thing that decides whether or not there's a trust, someone can be appointed as a neutral, right? You see the problem, though.
There's
whether
still,
it's this case, you see that problem.
There's still no authority for grabbing assets that don't belong
again,
to the
a different
trust.
Question. Let's say it's a different. You see the problem of accepting your argument as what that would mean for the incentives available to find people to do this work as neutrals.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think this is a very unique case. I don't think this comes up hardly ever where a trustee has taken ownership of the assets in a trust and moves them, and then you have a challenge to that afterwards. This is a very rare situation. Most times as you're a trustee, the trustees are the ones who have the power and the only ones who have the authority to move assets. And so as you're appointed as co-trustee, again, now you're in a position where this isn't going to happen because those assets can't be moved. They're going to stay there, and if at the end of the day the assets are still there and the court orders payment from the trust assets, then that's where reimbursement comes from. But if there's nothing in the trust to get reimbursed from, then there's simply no authority for that. And none has been cited. And in fact, all of the citations from both counsel and the district court have indicated that reimbursement comes from the Lawrence Trust.
Well, if I can, I don't know if you were done with your, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those cases that talk about the trust, and those are cases where there's only one trust at issue, right? Is there a case where you have something like this where there were mirror trusts and that both, and there's, you know, assets being moved from one to the other, and the allegation is that that should be undone and revert back to the initial trust? No. Or are the cases you're talking about where the trustee is paid from the trust where there's only one trust at issue?
This is a case where there's only one trust at issue.
That's a different question. I'm saying the cases that are cited, right? You and I might disagree about whether this is how unique this is, but the cases that are cited, are those cases that resemble trusts like the two we have here?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. But this is a case where there was only one trust at issue. It was the Lawrence Schwagel litigation. The Phyllis Trust was not involved in that piece. The case that was appealed was the Lawrence Schwagel Trust. Mr. Wilson was appointed to the Lawrence Schwagel Trust.
Well, what happens when cases merge? What happens to those parties in the now merged case? Are they no longer parties if there's only one case number that gets appealed, or is it all the same now?
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, Your Honor.
Well, I think that I'm asking what if there is in one case two entities that are parties, and in another case there's a third entity that's a party, but only on that case number. Those get merged. What happens to those? Are they all parties now on all cases because they have been merged?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. They remain separate as far as their individual case numbers. The only merger we have here is on the appeal, and that's because there were actually four cases that were basically brought to the district court's attention at the same time. It all started to try to unfreeze these assets in the Phyllis Schwagel Trust, and then that kind of morphed into a motion for fees in the Lawrence Schwagel Trust, and then closing the other two litigation files as well. So everything got kind of jumbled into one order, which was appealed. But the Phyllis Trust was a very separate matter than the Lawrence Trust.
And I have one more question as it relates to kind of how the Phyllis Trust is involved here. As I read your principal brief and, you know, comparative to the reply brief, I didn't see any jurisdiction argument until the reply brief. So I wanted to know from you, are you saying that there's a jurisdictional problem with ordering the Phyllis Trust to pay fees, even though that's not in the principal brief?
That was raised in response to what respondent had said. And the jurisdictional issue, jurisdiction, of course, can be raised at any time. But absolutely, there's a jurisdictional issue with ordering the Phyllis Trust to pay fees for reimbursement out of the Lawrence Trust or incurred by the trustee of the Lawrence Trust. Absolutely.
So you're arguing, I presume, a subject matter jurisdiction argument.
Correct.
That's what you're saying?
Correct.
And is it really subject matter jurisdiction or just outside the authority of the statute? I mean, I think of those. I mean, discord generally has subject matter jurisdiction over trust matters under Chapter 501C. I'm just wondering if it's truly subject matter jurisdiction or just the statute doesn't authorize it.
The statute doesn't authorize it. The statute specifically limits the reimbursement from whatever trust establishes the trusteeship. And so trying to attach to any other entity is simply not authorized. And I would note on this fact
that is different than subject matter jurisdiction, as I see it.
Well, I'll, maybe so, Your Honor.
Important because, as you noted, you can raise this jurisdictional argument at any time. That might be the first thing that our court would have to address as a threshold question. But if it isn't, you know, precisely or correctly characterized as subject matter jurisdiction and better characterized as a lack of authority, then that might be something that isn't before us because it wasn't raised until the reply brief.
I believe that the lack of authority has been raised the entire time. That's the argument. That's always been the argument. I would note as well, though, that the district court's own, there was a suggestion that Barbara Higginbotham pay fees of the successor trustee, and the district court said, no, there's no authority for shifting payment. And yet in the very next paragraph, the district court did exactly that. It shifted payment to something else. Here, the Phyllis Trust. It doesn't matter whether it's Barbara Higginbotham, the Phyllis Trust, the Joe Ganji Trust. There's no authority to shift that payment, the reimbursement, to any other person or entity. And so the district court made a legal error there. I'm just about out of time, so I thank you for the court's questions.
And you will have some time on rebuttal. Any other questions from the panel at this point?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondent, C. Thomas Wilson. I want to start by just clarifying one part that came up in appellant's argument, and that is what Wilson knew at the time. So, yes, it's true that some of the assets were moved prior to his appointment, but they were moved in secret. Nobody knew that they were moved until after he completed his report as neutral trustee. And then when he became his successor trustee, he did so at a time when the trial court had found that there had been a breach of fiduciary duty, and so he anticipated reasonably that those assets would be recovered. So it was never the case that he was voluntarily agreeing to serve as trustee with the expectation that there were no assets in this trust. The fact of the matter is he did a lot of work for this trust and deserves to be paid for it. I think it's also important to look at what the trial court's order actually says. It directs that the $81,000 and some dollars be chargeable to the Lawrence Trust and or the Phyllis Trust to be apportioned as determined at the discretion of the trustees Diana Miller and Jerome Schwagerl. So to the extent they do not believe that the Phyllis Trust should be liable, they have the discretion to pay the fees through the Lawrence Trust.
Who's the trustee of the Lawrence Trust?
Diana Miller.
Okay. And so what are there... So if they decide it should come out of the Lawrence Trust, then the Lawrence Trust has to find that payment somehow?
Correct, which would presumably be from the land, however that would sort itself out. But the point is that in arguing that the Phyllis Trust should not be liable, what they're doing is trying to deny Mr. Wilson payment altogether. And that raises a number of problems, both equitably and with regard to, you know, wanting to encourage people to take these jobs as trustee going forward.
So what is this, I think I really want you to speak specifically to the arguments made, I think primarily in a reply brief, because obviously you didn't have a chance to respond to it, but that there isn't statutory authority under 501C that, like, for example, 0709 says a trustee is entitled to be reimbursed out of the trust property for expenses properly incurred. I think that goes to the attorney's fees argument. What the argument is, hey, there it is, black and white. It's only out of the trust property.
So I would direct the court to 501C0106, which says that principles of equity still supplement the trust code to the extent not expressly displaced. And so in the section that you're citing, it says that the trustee is entitled to be reimbursed from the trust property, but it doesn't say only from the trust property. And so I think those equitable principles still apply and still allow the trial court to say, you know, in these very unique circumstances, it makes sense to, you know, allow the trustee's discretion to pay either from the Lawrence Trust or the Phyllis Trust, but ensure that Mr. Wilson does, in fact, get paid.
And then I think the argument maybe from an appellant would be, yeah, but this was just the Lawrence Trust. Like, how can you just pull in a third party, which happens to be this other trust, and say, you have to pay it too? You're liable for it as well. Under equity.
Sure. A number of reasons. One is that we know that the assets were taken from the Lawrence Trust to the Phyllis Trust quite systematically. So they would have been Lawrence Trust assets. Two, we know that the trustees are the same and the beneficiaries are largely overlapping, so they're ultimately coming from the same pockets. We also know that here we have a real risk that he will not get paid if it's just the Lawrence Trust. And the Phyllis Trust has been involved with this case, you know, from the beginning, so it's not like we're taking from some random trust that has no connection here. And then fourth is that they offered as security on appeal the assets from the Phyllis Trust. They didn't offer any security from the Lawrence Trust. And so that seems to be an implicit decision by the trustees as to where they want to pay the money from. And so I think for all of those
respond to the reply brief on that, which is I think they're just protecting themselves in the event of a, you know, adverse decision. But it doesn't mean that they're somehow conceding that they could be liable for it.
Well, and if that's what they wanted to do, then they could have also put up security from the Lawrence Trust to say, okay, this is we'll freeze the $80,000 from the Phyllis Trust to protect if a judgment against the Phyllis Trust is affirmed, but then also have security from the Lawrence Trust to protect if a judgment on the Lawrence Trust is affirmed.
I mean, I understand the logic of that argument, but I don't think it has to be that way, right? Who and where the money comes to put up this security or the bond doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the merits of the arguments on appeal.
So I think it's one factor. I think the other things that I've pointed out as well are other ways that the court could reach the conclusion that it's equitable to reach the Phyllis Trust. I think it is an interesting factor that they chose to put up that as security. But certainly not the dispositive factor here. I think the fact that the assets were transferred there to the Phyllis Trust, the fact that the beneficiaries and the trustees are the same people.
What's the difference in beneficiaries between the two?
As far as I know, the only difference is that Phyllis cut out Barbara Higginbottom and I think possibly another sibling as a result of this litigation. She chose to cut them out of her trust.
Of the Phyllis Trust.
Yep. Yes. But other than that, I mean, it's really the same family. So the people that would be getting money from the assets if they were in the Lawrence Trust are the same people who are going to be paying the fees if they're paid from the Phyllis Trust.
I don't know how relevant it is, but if I could follow up, do you know how much overlap there was when those were initiated in the first place?
With the beneficiaries? I don't know the timing on if she moved the assets before or after she removed the beneficiaries.
Well, but at the time the trusts are set up, the beneficiaries were identical.
Yes, the beneficiaries were identical at the time that Lawrence and Phyllis both set up their trust.
Are there any cases where we're talking about fees or what the trust means under that statutory provision that involve, I think these are related trusts. They're, you know, at the same time, same beneficiaries, they were mirrored. So it seems like they were intended to be together in some form or related in some form. Are there any cases where we have looked at the statute and applied that to something like this?
I can't say that I'm aware of any. In general, there's not a lot of case law on when trustees get paid to begin with. So I don't think it's surprising that there's not any case law directly on point on these facts.
And are you making any argument that where the statute says the trust or those cases say the trust in this particular instance because of the nature of these two trusts that they're both part of what's encompassed by the trust? Or is your argument purely on the equitable side of it?
I think that's a reasonable interpretation of the statute to interpret the trust to include multiple related trusts when, as you said, they are so clearly, you know, created at the same time with the same purpose by a married couple. I think that that is a reasonable interpretation of those statutes.
With respect to the benefit to the whether there was or would reasonably have been a benefit to the Phyllis Trust from the trustee's actions, Mr. Wilson's actions, is that necessary in your view for the Phyllis Trust to be? I know you argue there is, and we can turn to that. Is it necessary in your analysis for there to be? How does that come into play?
I don't think it is necessary for there to be a benefit to the Phyllis Trust. Certainly, if we're looking at equitable arguments, as an equitable matter, the trial court could find that it's equitable to award compensation from the Phyllis Trust, even if there was no benefit. But I think that there's arguments that there was a benefit here, and of course,
it's a factor within the equity balancing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Okay. And explain what I know that I think one thing you said, and I don't have in front of me right now, is that pursuing the fair market value for the sale of the farm property, which directly implicated, although obviously we know what the end result is, but it would implicate the Phyllis Trust's interest in that same property, right? The other things that you argue are a benefit to the Phyllis Trust, that's less sure of, that even, what are they?
Well, for example, one of the arguments was, you know, they have the same trustees, so by raising the argument to the Phyllis Trust that these trustees have violated their duties, that may put the trust on notice that they should be looking into the trustees' actions with their trust as well. Okay. And then the other one was that Mr. Wilson was pursuing an action against the Phyllis Trust for a large amount of money, which was obviously accruing interest, and so to the extent that could be done quickly, it would cut down on the amount of interest. I think what's important is that it's what we're looking at here is a clear error standard, and so the trial court, you know, found that there was a benefit to the Phyllis Trust. We've pointed out a number of reasons why you could reach that conclusion reasonably. And so it's not clearly erroneous for the trial court to make that finding.
Is that the right standard to decide if the trust should be liable, is whether that trust or, let's say, entity benefited from the trustee's work?
You know, I think whether that trust benefited from the trustee's work is not necessary. I think when you're looking at it through an equitable lens, you can award compensation from a related trust, even if it was not benefited.
Is there any case in your brief where you talk about the equitable factors that we can look to, including benefit to that entity?
I don't know if there's case law specifically on that point that we've cited, but it is ultimately...
What about the district court? How clear is it that the district court was acting in its equitable powers and looking at certain factors to determine whether under those powers it was permissible to include both trusts?
Well, I think the district court's order is most clearly understood that way because I don't think there's a lot of other ways that you could reach that conclusion. I think that that's what you're left with. I agree that the trial court's order is perhaps a bit on the short side, but that doesn't mean that it's not supportable. It certainly is.
I have two questions. First, I apologize for this. I'd like you to circle back just so I have it in mind. At the beginning, you talked about, you placed in context the appointment of Mr. Wilson. Could you do that one more time for me? You said two things.
Sure, two things. The first is when he was appointed neutral trustee, they did not know at that time that there was no assets in the trust because Phyllis had moved the assets to the Phyllis Trust without telling anybody. So it wasn't until he completed his report as neutral trustee that they realized the assets had been moved. The second key point is when he agreed to be successor trustee. And that was at the time that the trial court had found that Phyllis breached her fiduciary duty. It was before the appeals, and the trial court had instructed Mr. Wilson to bring an action to recover the assets.
So his initial appointment was as?
Neutral trustee.
A neutral trustee, and then he is appointed as successor.
And then he's appointed as successor trustee. And my point is that at both of those times, he had every reason to believe that there would be assets ultimately available to pay his fees. So it wasn't as though he was volunteering to do this out of the goodness of his heart.
The district court talked about section 549.14. Does that have anything to do with this case? That seemed to me more when someone's trying to recover against a trust, whether you get it from the trust or from the trustee in a given case, less about a trustee seeking compensation from a trust.
Could you remind me briefly what section said?
Oh, section 549.14, because I think the district court order, if I remember right, cites only that. It doesn't cite the 501C provisions that you cite. I'm just wondering, and you talk about it, you briefly talk about it in your brief, I think, in page 20, that statute, when you're talking about there's, you know, whether the trustee mismanaged the action, et cetera. I'm just wondering whether that statute actually has any play here at all in your legal analysis of paying the trustee.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not necessary to. I think the other statutes that we've relied upon are sufficient. I certainly don't want to disclaim any of the reasons or rationale that the trial court relied on as well that could also be useful here. Okay. But to conclude just briefly, I would say we didn't get to talk about any of the specific factual findings about whether he's entitled to compensation at all. But if the court does reverse any of those, I would just ask that it be very specific in its remand instructions. I know this case has been going on for quite some time, and I expect if there's any ambiguity, there may be additional litigation. So I think all of the parties would appreciate that. And with that, I would just respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Judge Bryan, you made a comment about how in the statutory language that when it talks about the trust or the trust estate that this might include related trusts. That is the first time that issue or that idea has ever been brought to the attention of anybody. And that's, I don't believe, properly before the court and shouldn't be looked at.
Well, it doesn't seem like... Well, I don't know. Let me ask you, what do you think the district court did? It certainly appears that the district court thought of the trust as related. There's not a lot of discussion about how they're different.
I don't believe the district court looked at them as being related, as in one and the same. I believe what the district court, which they're not. Of course, they're two different trusts. Even if they're mirror provisions, you still have two different trust vehicles. But I think, and I don't believe the district court looked at this from an equity standpoint either. What the district court did was there's one finding about a benefit, and that's basically the only finding you have related to the Phyllis Trust. And then you get to the end and you have order of judgment to both trusts. And to me, when you're looking at benefit, there's specific law on whether a trustee has provided a benefit to the trust. I believe it's in the context of specifically the attorney fees that were incurred. But that has to do with whether the trustee is entitled to reimbursement, not where it comes from. I don't believe there's any case law anywhere where a trustee is awarded compensation outside of that trust vehicle, whether in principles of law or equity.
Do you think it's clear on what basis the district court did that?
The basis that the district court ordered reimbursement from the Phyllis Trust?
From both, right.
I don't. I think the only thing that I can guess is that finding of a benefit. And that's the only thing to me that would give
that
rise.
Seems more like a factor than authority to do so. Right, I'm looking at the statute cited in the district court. I see just 549.14. I don't see case law like what the parties have put in their briefs about this. There's no mention of equitable powers. So it's not completely clear what authority the district court was operating under. It is clear that the reasoning is because of the benefit to the trusts together, and specifically there is a finding about a benefit to the Phyllis Trust. I see that reasoning, but unless you're seeing something I'm not, I'm not able to find something specific in the district court order about its authority or under what authority it was making that decision.
Agreed, Your Honor. I don't believe there's anything specific on what authority the district court was using, and I think that's probably because there is no authority for that, for what the district court did. A brief comment about the timing here. I believe counsel is incorrect on Mr. Wilson's knowledge. What we had is a district court order in January that required the parties to find a neutral trustee and then ordered Phyllis Schwagel to answer discovery, and I believe she did before she died, and that discovery included handing over a copy of the trust and then disclosing things that happened with the trust, and then that leads to an amended petition, and I think two amended petitions, and then Mr. Wilson is appointed, so I'm not sure that timing is necessarily correct. We didn't really get to talk much about how much Mr. Wilson would be entitled to. Just a brief comment that this is not a case where I'm saying that it was simply unwise for him to pursue the litigation as successor trustee, or in hindsight, just because it wasn't successful. This is a situation where the entire basis for even sustaining the litigation was subject to reversal. And if reversed, there would be no grounds to sustain that litigation at all. Every penny would be completely wasted that he spent. And a reasonable trustee, when encountering that, would hit the pause button and make sure that they continue so that any fees incurred would not be a complete waste of time and money.
I understand, well, let me ask you this. All right, so you, as the appellant, have to show prejudicial error. You're arguing, regardless of what the district court cited, you know, you have to show that its decision is wrong, that you were prejudiced by it. Are you arguing that the statute's precluded and there's no, and on, that making Phyllis Trust liable, jointly liable, and that there is no recourse to law of equity? That the statutes are the entire universe one can look at, and equity cannot be looked at.
My position is that if equity can apply, that the district court did not do that. The argument wasn't presented. There's no specific principle of equity that the district court relied on. There's no specific principle of equity that's been argued to this court. There was a brief note about unjust enrichment, which of course has a number of factors involved, but that was not a principle of equity that was ever relied on. So if equity applies, it wasn't applied in this case. Instead, what the court did was it found a benefit to the Phyllis Trust and then ordered judgment against both trusts. And it didn't factor in any principles of equity and didn't cite to any authority for doing so. Should be reversed because of that reason. There are no further questions. Thank you for the court's time.
I have one quick question before you sit down, and that's if I'm trying to find the docket number, the best number to look at for what arguments were presented about this and whether or not those arguments included this equitable powers authority, do you happen to know the docket number I can go to?
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you both for your arguments today and for the written submissions. We will issue an opinion within the 90 days.